I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A gunman opened fire late last night on an outdoor country music festival on the Las Vegas Strip. At least 50 people were killed and more than 400 were injured. The shooter, a 64-year-old man, killed himself. Today, the morning after the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history, we'll ask what it means for the gun debate in this country. After that, we'll switch gears. The catchphrase of the internet age could very well be disruption, disruption, disruption. But shopping for groceries seemed largely immune to digital disturbance. Thanks to Amazon's purchase of Whole Foods, is that about to change? We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. We're going to continue this morning with our focus on Sunday's mass shooting in Las Vegas. Joining me now is Judge Phil Jerney, who sits on the bench of the 19th Judicial District of the District Courts of Kansas. He's an endowment member of the NRA and a former state senator from Wichita. And Judge, thank you for joining us again. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you. I don't know why we have to be here only the moment after these tragic incidents, but, I think I'd like to echo what our congressional delegation, and I'm sure many of our listeners are saying that, you know, their prayers are with the victims and thanks for the responders. And
right.
It's really early to try to draw any conclusions or strings of incidents from this incident. Of course, they can't even figure out what the gentleman's motivation
right.
was.
But, Judge, you know, in the days to come, certainly the questions about gun control are going to arise once again. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, if the answer to these shootings isn't stricter gun control, then what can be done legislatively to lessen the chances of more shootings like this one?
Well, I think that when you look at past incidents that we have complete information about, I mean, Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook, Killeen, Texas, San Ysidro, California, San Bernardino, California. They're all mental health-related incidents, individuals mm-hmm. that are clearly, easy to say, after the incident, a danger to themselves or others. In almost all of those incidents, there were warning signs. There were issues that were looked at by mental health professionals. And the reality is, of course, that in the last 30 years, government has essentially gutted the mental health system across the country.
Right.
You know, we had 5,000 mental health beds in Kansas, and now the courts struggle to find a place to put the ones they believe they need to put there.
So your answer to this would be a renewed focus on mental health in Kansas and across the country then?
Well, I think it's quite clear that in many instances, for example, with James Huberty, the McDonald's in San Diego, he tried to get a mental health appointment and the day before the shooting, and his call wasn't returned.
Why has mental health and the focus on mental health, Judge, why has that languished over the years in this country? You hear politicians talking about its importance.
You know, I think it's pretty obvious to me, and I'm sure it will be when people see the big picture. We always see those that go to gun control rather than to try to resolve or solve the underlying problems in our society, because gun control doesn't cost anything.
Well, why not a two-pronged approach here, Judge? Why not mental health and gun control?
Well, because that costs money. I mean, you know, if you really get down to how governmental bodies operate right now, I mean, everybody, especially after the 2007-2008 Great Recession, you know, governments across the board, across the nation, from a city to a county to a state level, have struggled to meet budgetary to meet their budgetary requirements.
And this morning, Judge, a lot of Americans would say they'd be willing to spend more money to do whatever it takes to stop this kind of carnage in the future.
Well, and you know, and I certainly would say that that's probably something people will say until they get their tax bill. You know, we're going to see how the huge tax increase in Kansas pans out in the 2018 election cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it is easy to say that until it's time to pay the bill.
So from your vantage point, Judge, gun control remains off the table. Am I hearing you right?
Well, you know, I mean, what do you want to do? I mean, you know, what's the proposal? Right now, it's apparent from all of the news conferences in this incident so far this morning that this person has not had any law enforcement contact of any kind, that they find nothing but perhaps a traffic infraction in his whole record. And so,
but people heard the sound of those gunshots. But people heard the sounds of those gunshots being fired last night on the Las Vegas Strip, the rapid fire machine gun style cadence of those bullets being fired, and people will wonder, why should anyone have access to that kind of weapon?
Well, they have not actually described what type of firearm he had. And
okay.
I heard the video too and was surprised at the rate of fire. I think that it is difficult to say what was going on there. And, you know, the reality is that everyone has said only semi-automatic from what I've seen this morning. And, you know, we've tried regulating semi-automatic firearms in the early 1990s, and it really didn't have an effect. The statistical truth is that while this is certainly a horrendous and tragic event, that these types of events are quite rare. Now, they're the ones we hear about in the news every day, but we don't hear about the other 86 deaths, I suppose, that occur every day in this country.
But even if they are statistically rare, Judge.
Nobody's talking about, let's ban Hemi Motors because of the Dodge Challenger in South Carolina.
But even if they are statistically rare, is it time to stop using that as a defense against stricter gun control?
I don't know that the reality of any real gun control will do anything that will reduce these incidents. I mean, Steve, what do you think it would take to get, maybe 20 million firearms out of circulation in this country?
Well, a lot of people would say we got to start somewhere, Judge.
If you want to ban possession of these firearms, one, you know, you've got the Fifth Amendment, the United States Constitution says you can't take people's property without compensation. So what have other states done? Because they don't want to pay that bill either, like they did in Australia. I mean, Australia ended up, you know, they gave them a fraction of what they were worth, but they paid every gun owner for the guns that they turned in.
Yeah.
So, you know, what have states done? You know, California says, you can keep what you got, but you can't get any more. Colorado. I mean, you know, the movie theater shooter. There's another one that had a mental health issue, obviously, because they were able to effectively use a mental health
just a final point, Judge. Would even those changes, it would be a start down the road, at least some people would say. Could you get behind that? Could the NRIA get behind that?
You know, the National Rifle Association, and I have had some experience with the organization, supports common sense things like, you know, background checks, which, you know, they have implemented down a national basis to avoid transferring firearms to individuals with convicted felons. And I personally worked on legislation in Kansas that reported those individuals found by the probate court to be a danger to themselves or others and subject to an involuntary committal
right.
to the FBI. Before 2006, Kansas just didn't tell anybody.
Yeah.
And there was nothing to keep someone who had been found in a due process hearing from purchasing a firearm, even though it's a violation of federal law, because Kansas didn't bother to tell the FBI so they could put them in the national database.
And that's changed now.
And yes, yes, I was the sponsor of legislation that forced courts to go back years in their records to tell the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, which is the portal for the convictions and things like that, to go to West Virginia, where they run the background check system, and, you know, improve these things. And there are things states can do to improve that reporting.
Judge, I'm going to have to scoot on down the road here. I really appreciate you taking some time. Judge Phil Jurny sits on the bench of the 19th Judicial District in Kansas. He's an endowment member of the NRA.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Judge. You bet.
You bet.
Joining us now is Don Hader Markell, who teaches political science at the University of Kansas, and he follows gun politics. Don, thank you for taking some time.
Good morning.
Another mass shooting here. I guess the question on the table is, does this change the equation of the gun debate? How do you see it here this morning?
I haven't seen anything yet that would suggest that the narrative over guns has changed in this country. I mean, we look at each of these incidents as they occur, and some elements of what's happened sometimes lead us to think that the debate may shift things and the gun control advocates may get an upper hand. But I think following Sandy Hook, I think that being perhaps in many ways the most tragic of recent events, that not really shifting the debate, I don't see anything in the elements of this crime that would suggest the debate will shift.
What about this notion, Don, of the rapid-fire nature of the shootings last night, sounding, at least to my uneducated ears, something close to a machine gun, semi-automatic at a minimum. What about, you know, banning those kinds of weapons?
Yeah, as the judge said, I mean, we had done that back in 1994. We had banned certain rifles that are assault-style rifles and had the capacity for short bursts. And that ban was allowed to expire in 2004. And there is empirical evidence to suggest that that ban didn't have much of an effect on either crime rates or murder rates with firearms or anything like that. But it's also, I mean, at least having listened to the video of the attack,
right.
It sounds to me like those weapons may have been modified. They easily could have been bought legally and then illegally modified. There, certain weapons have pretty simple solutions for turning them into automatic weapons. It's being able to get a to be able to hold enough rounds simultaneously to fire more than, say, 30 or 40 at a time.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, people are in shock this morning. They're looking for answers. They're looking for a path forward. Is there one?
It's not clear to me. Like I say, I don't see how this automatically changes unless we see leaders change their attitudes or previous positions. I don't think the typical pattern is going to shift. You know, on the ground, the gun owners and gun advocates are better mobilized politically, NRA or no NRA. They are simply better mobilized politically than gun control advocates. And regardless of what people's attitudes are, when they don't act on them in elections, we can't really expect change.
You know, the NRA's latest drive, and this is going to surprise people, is to legalize silencers, I'm told. How might a silencer have affected the outcome here and what happened last night, Don? I mean, does this change the debate on silencers?
I think it could slow down the push for legislation to allow for silencers, partly because there is a pretty easy argument to be made, especially in a public venue like that, that had a silencer been used on any of the firearms that he was firing, that people would have had even less less sort of notice of what was happening. At the same time, this was in the middle of a concert, which is now becoming something of a trend. And it's not clear to me how many at least based on the videos I've seen, how much shooting he was able to do before before the music stopped and before people could actually hear the gunfire.
You know, you begin to wonder if people in this country start to become hesitant to show up at massive outdoor events like the one last night in Las Vegas. If people begin to think, man, this is getting too dangerous. We had obviously a shooting last night in Lawrence. It wasn't at a concert. Over the weekend, we had a shooting, and that's raised some eyebrows. If people simply grow reluctant to gather in groups in a public sort of way, maybe that begins to change thinking.
Well, that's certainly possible. And I mean, we've seen ever since 9/11 that people do change their habits based on these kinds of events. And certainly people will be less like some people will be less likely to go out into public spaces. But I think most people will continue on with the same behavior. And I say bravo because if you allow this to change your behavior, you sort of given in to this sort of living in a fearful state. And while there's certainly things to fear, I don't think you can live your entire life that way. And I certainly would think that if people feel like they need to change some behavior, they need to change the behavior in terms of their political behavior if they want certain outcomes to occur.
What is it you want to learn about the shooter that would be revealing and telling about motives and who this guy was?
Oh, geez, there's so much.
Hmm.
There's so much I'd want to know. Partly I wanted to know. Although he does not have a criminal record, there was some notion that he had run-ins with local law enforcement. So I'd like to know more about that, as well as how extensive this gambling habit was. And then it turns out his father had been a relatively notorious bank robber. That had escaped from prison and was never re-caught. There certainly does seem to be the possibility of a mental illness linkage, and I don't think that should be ignored, or the idea that we don't have good enough mental health treatment in this country, because that's certainly true. But the suggestion is that's solely to blame, seems to be misguided at best, since we know, of course, most people with mental illness do not engage in this kind of activity. So it's one contributing factor potentially, but we also have to look at what weapons he was able to use. Was he able to purchase all those legally? Did he buy those, for example, at gun shows
Right.
or in private sales where there was no background check? Even so, nothing that's publicly available at this point would suggest that he'd be in categorized as somebody not e able to pass a background check. So I mean, I think there's a lot going on there, but nevertheless, I think looking at multiple elements of this and not just pointing to strictly saying this is mental health or we need more gun control, I think there are multiple avenues to pursue in terms of thinking about solutions.
That's Don Hayter Markell. He teaches political science over at the University of Kansas. Don, always appreciate you taking some time. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Doug Parisi. He's director of training at Safe Defend in the Metro and a former police captain. Doug, thanks for joining us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Just real quickly, what is Safe Defend, Doug?
Safe Defend, we are a company that works with schools, businesses, government institutions, and we work based on OSHA recommendations to provide notification systems and training to employers and staff about hostile intruders. It's a kind of a rapid response notification system. We found that the two things you can do to prepare for these types of situations is one, notify people that there's a threat, and two, train them on how to respond. And that's what we focus on.
You know, people going to events like the one last night in Las Vegas, what should they be aware of before going and once they arrive at the venue or any venue for that matter?
Well, when we go through the training that we provide, one of the most important things I tell people is they have to get past some of the societal norms, and they have to be a little more expectant of where, like, sort of emergency exits are and what protocols are. We don't think a lot of times that if we get close to the stage, the only entrance and exit we're aware of is the one we came through. We don't stop to think, hey, if there's a crisis, there's probably shelter or at least exit from the venue kind of behind the stage. And when something happens like this, sort of all those normal rules of no entry are off limit, those are gone, and that's the way you need to head. You also just need to, in every one of these large venues, whether it's, you know, Manchester, the Avril Lavigne concert, or whether it's these soccer stadiums, or even the Fort Lauderdale shooting at the airport, you have to just know where the exits are. And I'm not saying to be hyper-vigilant and scared all the time, but at least look around and say, what is my closest exit based on my current location?
You know, in your business, you developed a relationship with the Las Vegas Police Department. You know, you've got thousands of people to control, hundreds of shots fired, and a shooter to find. How does a department deploy in a situation like the one we saw last night?
Well, human intelligence on the ground, the officers that were there, they very quickly focused in on the direction of the shooting. And then we are getting reports, and it hasn't been confirmed, but from one of the officers that I spoke with, that they actually did see the muzzle flashes coming from the Mandalay Bay once they started looking for them. So that's how they were able to focus on that. What's interesting is that the officers were using their radios. There's some video footage where the officers are ducked down behind cover, and they're on their radios talking and pointing. And there's civilians that are just standing probably 20 feet in the open out behind them using their cell phones and, you know, filming it. And so that's another thing, is kind of that awareness. But the officers there, that's what they're using, as the human intelligence to gather the direction to head. And then they would crash that area as quickly as possible.
That's Doug Parisi. He's director of training at Safe Defend and a former police captain. Doug, thanks so much for taking some time on short notice. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to switch topics dramatically, move away from the tragedy last night in Las Vegas, and we're going to talk about buying your groceries online. I'm Steve Kraske. You're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's show, our indie foreign and documentary film critics return to discuss the movies you need to see and the ones you can avoid. You can find those conversations at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we talk with an expert in cowboy history, and we'll explore the facts and the fiction of the Old West. Then author and environmentalist Bill McKibben discusses the fight to end our reliance on fossil fuels. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, we had planned to have author Steve Paul on the show this morning to talk about his new book on Ernest Hemingway before the events of Las Vegas last night. We plan to get Steve back on the show again sometime soon. In the meantime, you should know he'll be speaking at 6:30 Tuesday evening, that's tomorrow night, at the Plaza Branch at the Kansas City Public Library. More information, kclibrary.org. Now on to our second topic today, and that's online groceries. And is America ready to buy its groceries online? With its purchase of Whole Foods, Amazon clearly thinks so. But what about the rest of us? These days, we're buying almost everything online, but there's one big exception, and that's groceries. What are the hang-ups? What's the future look like? That's what we're going to talk about right now. With us, Luke Runyon is a reporter with Harvest Public Media. He joins us from KUNC in Colorado. Luke, good morning.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Louise Keeley is an executive vice president and global retail practice leader at Nielsen. Louise, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Louise, let me start with you. Just where do you think this online grocery store business thing is going, and where are we headed here?
So this online grocery thing is headed toward omnichannel. So it's not online versus offline. It's not one or the other. It's going to be shoppers and retailers using both channels interchangeably in different ways to make consumers' lives better going forward.
You mean both channels? You mean actually going to a store and also buying online?
Yeah, and I mean, if you think about the whole shopping process for groceries or for other products as well, we use online tools to look for new products, to shop for prices, to read about products. We use apps on our phones while we're at home or in the store. We might make a purchase online and pick it up in the store, or just do it the old-fashioned way and drive to the store and do our grocery shopping there and take it back. But people are going to move back and forth between these channels as their needs change. It might depend on the day of the week or the time of the day or who they're shopping for, what they're shopping for. And retailers are increasingly responding to that need for flexibility, not just in grocery, but in grocery too. And so, you know, the Amazon Whole Foods acquisition is a reflection of that.
Luke Runyon with Harvest Public Media. We're hearing a whole lot of talk about online grocery shopping these days, but, you know, it's not come into my orbit yet, and I'm wondering when I should expect to see this phenomenon and when it's going to reach me, Luke.
Well, I think the Amazon-Whole Foods merger is a sign of things to come. Mm-hmm. The merger was about a $13 billion merger. It's one of the largest acquisitions that Amazon has ever partaken in. And I think it shows where the whole industry, the whole grocery retail sector is headed. It's moving in that direction, and Amazon being one of the largest e-commerce retail giants in the entire industry shows that there's an interest on their part in going towards grocery shopping. And I think you'll start to see other legacy grocery retailers going in that same direction to follow Amazon.
Louise, I'm wondering if we should, the typical consumer out there might expect to see this online grocery phenomenon come at them in waves. Like, will it begin with in-store pickup of our groceries? You know, you order what you want online, you go pick it up at the store. Is that a probable next step here?
So it's going to be different for different types of shoppers. So some people, yes, it will be starting where you make your purchase online and you pick it up in the store. For other people, it's not even going to be buying it online. It's just going to be using and going to a website and shopping around for different deals, or looking at new products and figuring out where to go. So it's gonna come at people in different ways. It's gonna depend on whether they live in cities or in suburbs or rural areas. So there's not gonna be one path. It's gonna depend on what's available to people.
Luke, why is online grocery shopping sort of the last iteration of online shopping? Why is it taking groceries so long to get to our doorstep? And we've been buying books online forever. Why not groceries?
I think for a few reasons. One is sort of the obvious, that people like picking out what they get, and there's a huge variability in fruits and vegetables that you get at the grocery store. You know, you can just in one bin of apples, you can have some that are bruised, some that aren't, some that just appeal to people differently. And so that variability has made it really difficult. Whereas if you're buying a book online, all the books are the same. So that's one reason. I think that's why grocery has been this sort of last segment of the retail sector that has that hasn't really been seen an upheaval from online grocery shopping.
But certainly if you want to buy a can of peaches, Luke, I mean, you can go online and get a can of peaches and it's in a can and nothing can happen to it. So I'm wondering, again, with so much money at stake here, why your host hasn't been able to buy a can of peaches online until recently?
I think there just hasn't been that much of a demand for it, really. And that's why you're starting to see more of this movement in acquisitions and mergers among some of these grocery retailers or legacy grocery retailers moving towards apps or some sort of contract situation where they're maybe not providing the service of like a curbside pickup where you'd order online and then drive to your regular grocery store and someone would come out of the store and just put your groceries in your car. They're not doing that themselves. They're contracting out with some of these other services. But yeah, there really just hasn't been a demand. But in the past few years, you've seen this proliferation of meal kit delivery services like HelloFresh and Blue Apron. And there's at least some sort of feeling in among analysts who say that has sort of primed the pump. So people have become more comfortable with getting food delivered to their doorstep and making food at home from that delivery. And that now there's going to be this floodgate that opens because you have a certain segment of consumers who feel comfortable with that now and have had good experiences with that now and are saying, yeah, I've tried Blue Apron, maybe I'm going to try Amazon Fresh and see if that works out for me, too.
I'm just wondering, Louise, if I'm an aberration, because I like going to the grocery store after work. And, you know, you bump into your neighbors and you walk around, and I'm very picky about what kind of banana I like to buy for my breakfast. I mean, I'm just wondering, am I weird, or am I how typical am I?
No. So, you know, there's another thing I would just add to what Luke said in terms of why it hasn't taken off. It's just the economics of online grocery shopping. So people talk about this last mile problem. Grocery retailers haven't figured out how to make money from online grocery shopping, to be perfectly honest, because it's actually expensive to do the shopping for somebody and deliver it. And like you said, some people like grocery shopping. Some people take pleasure in it. There are countries where it's taken off more, like in the big cities in China or even in the UK. And in China, labor costs are much lower. So online grocery shopping has taken off. That's part of it is, you know, that people have habits, and habits are hard to break, especially if people take some pleasure in it. And there's some uncertainty, like Luke said, around what are you really getting? And I really want to pick it out. The other thing is, you know, just building on the meal kits idea, the lines between different types of food and beverage shopping, you know, what's grocery shopping, what's restaurant shopping, those lines are blurring, and meal kits are one example of that. Mm-hmm. But people are increasingly shopping not only for groceries online, but buying food from restaurants online and having it delivered for consumption in the home. So you know, we see more and more grocery stores having prepared foods or even restaurants and cafes within their four walls. So all the lines between food and food shopping and different types of food consumption are blurring. It's really exciting, and online grocery shopping is going to be part of that. But it's going to be part of this bigger ecosystem. And grocery retailers, including Amazon, but others as well, are trying to figure out how to make the economics of it work. And once they do that, then they will also figure out how to make it, I think, better for consumers and more comfortable for consumers, that they're willing to buy that banana online.
Yeah, Louise, I'm really struck by the fact that, and just reading about this last night, the U.S. is really behind, as you're pointing out, other countries that have really rocketed ahead when it comes to, you know, online grocery shopping. Is it labor costs? Is that the main reason why it's not more common here?
That's one reason. That's certainly the main explanation. If we compare the U.S. to China, in the U.K., you know, the U.K. is a much smaller country, much more densely populated, and so with a different distribution and logistics system. So they've also had fresh prepared foods much more prevalent in the grocery stores than we have here, and that's also a reason why online grocery was introduced earlier, I think, there than here. So part of it is just kind of an openness and willingness to shop for things online. Some of it has to do with, again, the economics, the kind of the cost structure of online grocery shopping, whether it's distribution and logistics or labor costs or something else.
Yeah. So, well, let me get our listeners involved here. We're wondering how ready you are to switch habits and try online grocery shopping. What would stop you from doing it? Give us a shout. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Our topic today is online grocery store shopping. Say that five times fast. Luke, along those lines, you talk about these different stores that Amazon is trying out right now. There's Amazon Fresh, there's Amazon Local Market, there's Amazon Go. Can you explain what those three different types of stores are?
Yeah, so Amazon Fresh is sort of the largest umbrella under those ones that you just listed. So Amazon Fresh is the grocery delivery and sometimes pickup service that Amazon has. So this has actually been around for about a decade. They started it in Seattle, and it's what you would imagine as your typical online grocery store. So you'd go on to the Amazon website. They'd have a portal that shows you all the different products that they're offering on Amazon Fresh. You make your order, and then a refrigerated bag will show up on your doorstep either the same day or the next day, depending on maybe the city that you live in.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon Local Market is sort of a subset underneath Amazon Fresh, and this is Amazon's push to really source local products.
Ah.
So they're coming into cities where they are launching their Amazon Fresh, sending people out to build relationships with local food makers. So maybe that's like the donut shop in your city that everyone really loves. They're not huge, they're small, and they're not, you know, necessarily who you would think of retailer would want to approach right away. They're pretty small potatoes. But Amazon sees this benefit of offering local products on its platform so that somebody in Denver could go on and say, you know, I really want to get those donuts from that local shop, and I want them part of my traditional grocery order. And then that would all be put together in a box that would show up on your front doorstep.
How about Amazon Go?
I am actually not quite sure what Amazon Go is.
Okay. Louise, do you know?
I'm not an expert on this, but that's the in-store experience where you can come in and you can shop and walk out.
They have prepared foods, I think. You walk in, they have a little, you don't even check out, you just walked out the door and your stuff's automatically scanned, I think, Luke.
Right. Yeah. So there's no cashier in the actual store. You basically just you walk in, you pick up whatever you want, put it into a little basket, and then walk out, and your account is charged for whatever it is that. Yeah. So kind of seems a little futuristic, but they're kind of beta testing that right now.
I don't believe any of these concepts are in Kansas City yet, Luke. Do you know that or not?
Amazon Fresh is not. And it actually, to kind of go back to what Louise was talking about, the logistics side of things, you can kind of see that mapping out in where Amazon Fresh is right now in the U.S. So it has a really heavy presence on the East Coast, on the West Coast, and in some major cities in the inner part of the country. But, you know, it's really harder to make the logistics work in a place outside of those really densely populated metropolitan areas.
We're talking about buying your groceries online. What do you make of that? Our phone number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Grover from Independence. Grover, you're on the show. Good morning.
Good morning. My problem is I've tried the pantry through Amazon, and nothing is static. The products aren't static. The pricing isn't static. So I can't budget for anything because one week it'll be one price, the next month it's another. Case in point, dish soap went from $2.99 to $4.99 to $8.99. Peas, if you buy canned peas or something like that, it may not be there next month. So there's no continuity to it at all. I'd rather go to a local vendor that I know is going to have what I'm familiar with and what the pricing is that I can budget on a monthly basis for, instead of, I get a bill for $400. And I don't know exactly why it went up, but, it's gone up.
Louise, do you have any sense of why the prices are bouncing around like that?
That's really interesting. Yeah, so dynamic pricing is something that happens more online than offline, which is, prices moving in response to consumer demand. And that's actually probably also something that we should all get more used to, that prices are going to adjust more and more, not just online, but eventually in stores as well. And it's kind of too bad that you had that experience, because in principle, one of the benefits of online grocery shopping and online shopping in general, right, is that you can track more easily what you've bought in the past, what the prices are,
right,
and be able to kind of keep track of it. Like that should be one of the cool things that you can do when you shop for your groceries online. So seems to me that, this is new for all of us, and so there's going to be some pain points to work through, and, certainly that sounds like one of them for this listener.
Let's go to Juan from Independence. Juan, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to call in because I actually use Hy-Vee Aisles, which is through the local Hy-Vee there in Independence. And you can either have it delivered or you can pick it up. And it's actually been great. I've been doing it for about 2 months now, and I've had my groceries delivered every 2 weeks. And I think they've missed one item. You can tell them whether or not you're okay with them switching out for a different version of the same item or not. But it's been pretty great. I went grocery shopping one time, I think a couple weeks ago, and it was awful.
Does it cost more money, Juan, to do it through the Hy-Vee aisle program that you're describing?
It does not, actually. As long as you're spending at least $100, they will deliver it to your house for free.
No kidding. No kidding.
Yeah, and it's amazing.
Okay. Glad to know about it, Juan. Thank you.
And it's available for pickup as well.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Let's go to Paul from Kansas City, Missouri. Paul, good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to have you, Paul.
We just moved here from Connecticut, where we use a service called Peapod, and we ordered online. It was delivered. We are very happy. Can't find anything like that locally.
Okay, and you'd like to have one, it sounds like, Paul.
Definitely. Yeah. I am in a wheelchair and need help having food delivered.
I understand. I understand. Hey, Louise, what's your sense of a major market like Kansas City? How much longer do you think it'll be before folks like Paul can get the help they need and even can get a choice of providers who might deliver groceries to their door?
Well, it's a hard question to answer, but if we think about what's happened in other industries, we were talking a little bit about books earlier, what's happened in the book industry. We're probably at a point now where the percentage of people who've tried online shopping is about a quarter, and Amazon has been in the online grocery business for a little over a decade now. And if you look at what they did in the book industry, the kind of the takeoff of online books, online book hard copy book purchases, as well as the movement toward electronic reading, took off starting around 2000, and we're potentially at that inflection point right now. So, you know, Kansas City is a major U.S. city, and I would expect that it would, you know, in the next 1 to 3 years, we'll start to see places like that be affected by the trend toward online grocery shopping.
Luke, Steve,
I would just add to that too. I mean, now that Amazon owns Whole Foods Market, it acquired basically 450 stores across the country and built out its food distribution network basically overnight with that acquisition. Mm. So there's Whole Foods Markets in the Kansas City area. Those are now owned and operated by Amazon. And there's this sense that that is really how Amazon is going to start to kind of put its tentacles across the country to do more of this grocery delivery, grocery pickup. You know, basically now they have 450 pickup locations for online grocery shopping throughout the country, and that would extend to the Kansas City area as well.
How big of a deal, Luke? Go ahead, Louise.
I was going to say that's such a great point, and because those, even though it's only 460 stores, it reaches about 82% of U.S. shoppers. So not everyone shops in Whole Foods today, but you know it can reach all those people.
Luke, how big of a deal is this Whole Foods acquisition by Amazon? This is really revolutionizing the industry, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think you could probably divide the effects into two categories. So you have the short-term effects, which are already manifesting themselves. I was actually just in a Whole Foods the other day, and right when you walked in, there was a pamphlet that was saying new low prices on all of these products, and it had the logo of Whole Foods and Amazon together. So clearly they're trying to change this perception of Whole Foods as being only for the wealthy. You know, it has the nickname of Whole Paycheck, meaning that you're going to be spending your whole paycheck on groceries when you go there. And Amazon's whole mantra is ruthless efficiency. So, you know, sometimes that manifests itself as lower prices on products. So that's in the short term. And then in the long term, I think you're going to see this entire retail grocery sector changing. So Amazon's a huge player. They're in the grocery game now. That means that huge grocery retailers like Schnucks, Kroger, Hy-Vee, we heard earlier, are going to have to step up their game and compete with Amazon. And that means that they're going to be trying to woo more customers, more consumers to trying out some of these services.
You know, Luke, you talked to farmers and the impact it might have on them and the pressure for them to keep prices low with Amazon coming into the game. How is that going to play out?
Yeah, I talked to a grower. His name's Steve Ela, and he grows mostly fruit in western Colorado. And he has been with Whole Foods pretty much since they arrived in the Rocky Mountain region. And he was pretty surprised when he heard the news. He didn't really think of Amazon as a food retailer, which I think a lot of us are kind of having to adjust the way that we think about it now. And it, really, he wasn't that concerned. He's pretty diverse in terms of his marketing. So he said, basically, if Whole Foods under Amazon started pushing their prices down and then passed that price drop to the farmer, that he might just have to stop selling to Whole Foods altogether. He didn't want to, but if that becomes kind of the MO of Whole Foods under Amazon, then he'd really have no choice. He still has to make a living. And some of the concern that I've heard from farmers is that Whole Foods was one of these last big box retailers to actually give local farmers a premium price on their products. And that if they disappear, it's really going to be difficult to find another retailer that buys wholesale from farmers that gives them a pretty good price. And so I think, yeah, the farmers are watching this warily, I would say.
Let me go to one more call here from Christina, who has shopped at an Amazon Go. Christina's from North Kansas City. Hi, Christina.
Hi, Steve.
Go ahead. Tell us about Amazon Go, if you would.
Sure. So I was visiting my sister in Indianapolis this weekend, and we ordered from Amazon Go. We were going to make a meal, and you were kind of shopping from two different facilities, the local grocery store and then also the local Amazon warehouse. And only one of those facilities was able to send us a day of delivery. So we ended up trying to make this meal by collecting all these items and then only were able to receive half of them. So they have some kinks I think they still need to work out.
This is Amazon Go you're talking about.
Yes, Amazon Prime Go, I think is what it was called. It was basically just grocery delivery through an app.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for the call, Christine. I appreciate it. And Louise, you just have to wonder what this means for brick and mortar grocery stores going forward. And I got about 20 seconds left here.
Brick and mortar grocery stores are going to benefit from this. They're going to they're going to move into online, and people, like I said at the start, people are going to move between the channels. I don't think it's an us versus them. I think it's going to transform the way we shop, but we're still going to use stores.
Okay, that sounds good. I want to thank Luke Runyon, a reporter with Harvest Public Media. He joins us from KUNC in Colorado. Luke, always appreciate it.
Happy to be here, Steve.
And Louise Keeley is Executive Vice President and Global Retail Practice Leader at Nielsen. Louise, thank you again.
Thank you. Have a good day.
And our thanks to Steve Paul for being flexible because we covered the Las Vegas shooting in our first half today. Again, he speaks at 6:30 Tuesday evening at the Plaza Branch at the Kansas City Public Library. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, we'll look at the real lives and history of cowboys. Then author and environmentalist Bill McKibben discusses the politics of phasing out of fossil fuels. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.